Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? Welcome to the Around the World podcast. I'm your host, Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more in the Around the World podcast. My guest for this show is Lisa Olsen. She grew up in West Berlin and was a teenager when the wall came down. During our talk, Lisa explains the history of the Berlin Wall, and we discuss what it's like to live in a divided city. We also get into her forays in Lesotho, the United States, and Guatemala. I had a lot of fun talking with Lisa. Let me know what you think. Hey everyone, I'm here in Berlin, Germany with Lisa, and we're sitting here in her kitchen hanging out. We're going to have a little talk about, hopefully about Berlin. We'll see where else it goes. And welcome, Lisa. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hello.
Thanks for having me. I'm sleeping here with my girlfriend Katie too, and so we're grateful for the hospitality. We're here on a little summer vacation enjoying lovely Berlin. It's my first time in the city. It's been like a really interesting place to visit. There's so much history here and a lot of museums. And then currently even there's just always a lot happening.
Even though it's not very summery right now.
Yeah. That's kind of the one downside. It's been chilly.
Yeah.
And rainy, but otherwise I'm really liking this place. My girlfriend lived here for 2 years and absolutely fell in love with the city. So I'm kind of seeing why now.
It's the best city in the world.
It is. Spoken like a true Berliner.
Yes.
Yeah, so you grew up here?
I was born here, yeah. Okay. In the 70s, beginning of the 70s, in the western part, I was born and grew up in West Germany, in West Berlin, and specifically I grew up in Schönebeck, which is a district pretty close to the center of town. Very urban, residential neighborhood, densely populated, kind of in the middle of everything, yeah.
Wow. So you were right in the heart of everything that was happening.
I was, although I have to say that in the 70s and 80s in Berlin, not a whole lot was happening. I
mean, it was kind of stagnant.
Yeah, it was very, in a strange way, even though it was a large city, it felt very provincial. Berlin was very separated from the rest of Germany. There was a lot of extra special regulations that only applied to Berlin. Like, Berlin was the only place that didn't have military conscription. It got incredible amounts of government subsidies. Living here, people were encouraged to live here, to move here, because especially for business people, Berlin wasn't exactly a convenient place to run business from because it was essentially locked in and it was complicated to get to and to get out of. And so they tried to kind of keep this place running by making it attractive in all kinds of ways.
Wow. So it was Berlin's kind of right in the middle of what used to be East Germany, right? Mm-hmm. And you explained this to me really well the other day. Do you mind just kind of going into how Germany got separated? Because this isn't that obvious to a lot of people who might be listening to this.
Yeah, I mean, Germany got separated as a result of the end of World War II. So while the war was going on, a number of relatively large nations formed the anti-Hitler coalition, namely Russia, Great Britain, France, and the USA, when they did join the war. And while the war was going on for at least a year and a half, the leaders of those nations had been meeting in various places to kind of discuss, you know, in advance what would happen to Germany when they lost, which I think by 1944 was pretty apparent that that's what would be happening. And so when the war finally ended in 1945, you know, there was this essential agreement that the Allies had come to about what to do with, you know, this nation smack dab in the middle of Europe, which was to essentially divide it up into areas of control. And so, because Russia, I guess, of the nations that were in that coalition had, first of all, expended a whole lot of effort and suffered a lot at the hands of Germany, they were essentially, had negotiated kind of a larger piece of the pie, so to say. So in the Potsdam Conference in 1945, kind of the final decisions were made to divide up Germany kind of in half, and Russia would be in charge or would be able to occupy or do whatever politically and economically with the East, and then the Americans, the British, and the French would divide up the West into three equal pieces and then just kind of administer those regions and kind of be in charge. And that's what happened. The only kind of glitch in that negotiation was that Berlin, the capital of Germany, was, you know, smack dab in the middle of Russia's half. And so, because, you know, that was strategically a relatively important place, they said that they would go ahead and do the same thing with Berlin. So you just have to imagine it, you know, the same as, you know, Germany is a big piece of pie that was cut in half with the western half cut into three pieces. They did the same thing with Berlin. They took that little piece and cut it in half with the western half cut into three little pieces. So that's kind of how they had originally set it up. The problem was that after the war ended and the Allied powers had somehow occupied their little pieces of the pie, they were unable to really agree on how they wanted to run it. They had different political interests, different economic interests, and the Cold War was starting to rear its ugly head, so this conflict between the East and West ideologically became an issue. And so what happened was that Russia had decided that, you know, their primary interest would be to essentially recoup their losses by, you know, putting a puppet government into Germany and then just siphon off the resources that they could siphon off as much as possible. I'm sure there's other historians who will disagree with me, but this is my, you know, short version.
Right. Just to put it in layman's terms.
I mean, there's a lot of complex issues that I'm not explaining, but I mean, this is how, kind of how I simplify for
definitely that's what we need
for my students and Americans.
Yeah, and Americans. Well, you're a history teacher, right?
Yeah, I'm a history teacher.
So
The Western powers had different interests. First of all, this domino theory was starting to develop in the West, and especially in the U.S., with the assumption that, you know, if one nation was going to go communist and that was allowed to go forward, then the other nations near that nation or in that nation's control would then all topple to the same ideology and communism would spread, and that would be a horrible, horrible thing, of course. And so their idea, at least Great Britain and the U.S.'s idea, was that Germany would need to be strengthened in some way for two reasons. Number one, because they had lent Germany a whole lot of money and needed to somehow recoup that. And if Germany was going to, you know, essentially be left to its own devices to starve, there wasn't going to be any way that the Germans would be able to repay the debt. And second of all, they kind of had this idea that Germany could be a little bit of a like a bolster against communism, and that, you know, if they, you know, allowed Germany to just kind of rot, that it would become this nation susceptible to this virus of communism, and that they needed to somehow, you know, put a buffer between them and the growing communist influence from the East.
So that's kind of the proverbial line in the sand.
Exactly.
Right down the middle of Germany.
The line in the sand went right through the middle of Germany. And so what the Western Allied powers did, and I think this was, I I'm going to guess. I think it's like, I'm not very good with years, okay, dates, but I think it was 1948 or something like that. The Western powers decided, without consulting Russia, to institute a new currency in order to bolster the German economy. And they did that in just the Western half, which totally pissed Russia off.
Understandably.
And so, and what was happening is that the people living in East Germany, as a result of noticing, okay, yeah, the Western half of Germany is being economically supported in a way that the Eastern part is not getting, yeah, started to kind of move.
People started moving out of the East?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that also pissed Russia off.
Well, yeah.
Or even, you know, the East German government at that point, or whoever was in charge. It wasn't really clear at that point who was going to be in charge. There was a lot of preliminary systems that weren't really...
But whoever it was, they were all just puppets, right, to the...
Yeah, I mean, I hesitate to call people complete puppets. I mean, they were dependent. They were dependent.
Okay.
And so as a result of this kind of line that was drawn by the Western allies saying, okay, this is how we're going to run stuff here, and we're going to, you know, build up the West economically by instituting this new currency and by, you know, pouring money into the country and rebuilding industries and all that kind of stuff. The Russians said, okay, you can go ahead and do that in West Germany, but you're not going to do this in Berlin. That's not going to happen. You're not going to take control of Berlin this way. And so what they did is they built this blockade that prevented American money and American resources. I say American, it's really just Western, but America really has kind of the big say in this whole thing. To prevent that, all those resources to flow into the city of Berlin. And they completely shut off all access to the city, which led to something that people call the airlift, which is essentially American planes flying over West Berlin and dropping just masses and masses of supplies from, you know, in these little packets and crates from parachutes.
Oh, is this the candy bombers, were they called?
The candy bombers.
That's it. Okay.
Yeah. In English, they're called candy bombers. In German, they're actually called raisin bombers because raisins were a really popular thing to drop.
Raisin bombers, huh?
Raisin bombers. Okay. Rosinenbomber. That's what they were called. So, yeah. So, a lot of those planes took off and landed or dropped over Tempelhof Airport, which I think you're probably still going to go see while you're here.
Okay.
And so there's a huge memorial, blah, 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 over yeah. there. You'll read some of the history when you go.
Cool.
But yeah, so that blockade, the Berlin blockade, was one of the first, you know, for those who study history of the Cold War, that was really one of the first conflicts that kind of drew that line in the sand and that made this conflict between East and West become tangible and really kind of kicked off.
Yeah.
You know, what would then intensify during the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, all the way into, you know, the beginning of the 90s, this whole, rivalry, political rivalry between right. the East and the West.
To put it lightly.
Yeah. Yeah. But the wall itself, you know, that line in the sand was drawn in 1948, granted, but the wall itself wasn't built until 1961, so well into the Cold War, right around the time when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened and things like that. So this was, you know, nuclear armament had already progressed and, you know, it was not something that a lot of people think that it happened right after the war, but the wall really didn't happen until about 15 years later.
Right.
So again, the wall was built, or the wall, what we know today as the wall, is this enclosing of West Berlin inside the enclave of Russian-controlled Germany, so East Germany. And then, of course, there was the border between East and West Germany, which was significantly, it was about an hour and a half drive, 2 hours drive west of Berlin is the actual border between East and West Germany.
Okay, so you've got West Germany. Then if you want to go to Berlin, you go through East Germany for an hour and a half, 2 hours, Then you can enter the city. Was it just the one road that, or were there a couple of roads that you could just drive down?
There's about, I think there was like three main corridors. Maybe there was five. I mean, you could fly to wherever. Flying was
not the easiest.
Yeah. I mean, by the time that you got, you know, the wall was built and when I was born in the 70s and 80s, you know, I mean, I grew up, I was born 12 years after the wall was built. So I grew up with it as kind of a natural part of my environment. Like I didn't run around going, oh my God, you know, this wall is so crazy and so evil. Yeah. And oh, I can't believe, you know, that I live in a city that's totally enclosed. I mean, that didn't really happen. I mean,
you didn't feel like the literal wall just came.
No, it wasn't really closing in on me at all.
Oh, okay.
So
I guess it is a big enough city that you, if you're in the middle of it, you wouldn't really see it, right?
Did you
see it every day?
Yeah, no. I mean, not every day, but I live, you know, pretty close to it. Mm. Within, you know, maybe a 10-minute bike ride, you'd hit it.
Hmm.
But
well, I was just at the Wall Museum the other day, or 2 days ago, I think, and I loved reading about it and learning the history of it, but one quote that stuck with me was right when it was built, it seemed like there was almost a war between East and West, and the wall was almost a way to mitigate this war. At least that's how they kind of made it seem. And then someone said, well, a wall is better than a war, and that's the quote that stuck.
I
can't remember who said it now.
Yeah, I mean, there was lots of conflicts and lots of, you know, potential civil wars that happened here. There was, you know, the Prague Spring. Then there was, you know, 1953. There was a huge thing that happened here where, you know, the East German and West German, or the Allied forces, tanks were like facing each other across Checkpoint Charlie.
Oh, yeah. I saw a photograph of that.
Yeah.
Crazy.
So, I mean, there was lots of, you know, potential conflict that was happening. But that was the 80s. I mean, the 80s was all about people, you know, just carefully nursing this fear of this unknown power that they had very little information about. And, you know, imagining all the horrible things that could happen and how incredibly, you know, unpredictable they'd be, which I think, you know, in retrospect is a little bit ridiculous. You know, it's like, I think everybody knew and everybody knows that nuclear war is not really an option for a winner, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, the 80s was really all about this idea that you protect yourself against this evil by, you know, arming yourself to the teeth.
Sure.
And making sure that you were scary to them in some way.
Hmm.
It's very weird.
It seems weird looking back. I mean, I've even watched videos of, like, from my parents' generation in the 50s of them crouching under desks in case there's a nuclear strike. And
yeah, and strangely enough, we never did that.
You never did that?
No. I mean, I've seen...
And you're right in the middle of it.
I know. I know. I've seen videos of, you know, you know, that those kinds of things happening in the States. And I was just like, oh my God, like we were right in the middle of it. If anybody was going to, you know, have a reason to crawl under a desk, it probably would have been Central Europeans, but.
Right. Probably not someone from like rural Iowa. Right?
No, unlikely that you'd be the first hit, but.
Yeah. The level of paranoia is fascinating.
Yeah. No, we never did that. I mean, and I think that it's interesting looking back on, now, like my history classes, the wall was, or what we call the German question, was part of our history curriculum in 10th grade. 10th and 11th grade is when people started learning about the wall, which essentially, I mean, to be honest, like now, it's difficult for me to say what I would have learned, but I assume that it was a very Western biased curriculum. It's only that, you know, at the very beginning of 10th grade, the wall fell.
Oh, when you were in 10th grade?
When I was in 10th grade. And so I remember coming to school that day, like after the morning after that evening when the wall, you know, had been opened. I wouldn't say it fell that day.
Yeah, we always say it fell opened. As if it just... The wind just blew it over.
It tumbled. Yeah. No, but you know, a process that had been brewing over a few years, you know, came to the fore in this opening of border crossings all over Berlin. And so I went to school the next day and I went to history class, and I think my history teacher was there. There's a lot of teachers that weren't there.
Okay.
But my history teacher made a bunch of, you know, like semi-confused and relieved and excited jokes about how it would be relatively difficult to teach a curriculum about a German question now that we knew the answer. And it was an interesting day. It was an interesting day.
I'm sure if you're a history teacher, you're probably going, well, this is a day that we'll live in history.
Yeah, I wish that I had been a history teacher then. Back then, I was still aspiring to be a musical star, and I didn't have a lot of political interests, which is too bad, because I would have paid a lot more attention and been a lot more adventurous than I ended up actually being. Completely involved in other things.
You missed your chance.
I totally missed
it. You could have been Britney Spears before there was Britney Spears.
Yeah, exactly. I could have been, you know, or at least, you know, I could have much more amazing stories. I know a lot of my high school friends have amazing stories to tell about how, you know, they were dancing on the wall and they explored East Berlin and they did all these amazing things. I didn't do any of that stuff.
Was your class just empty or the next day? Or was it just normal, like a normal day?
Yeah, it was somewhat normal. I mean, at the time we were preparing, I was really deep into music and theater. And I was spending about, you know, 70 hours, 80 hours a week in school, in rehearsal, in performances, on stage somewhere, just making music and theater all the time. And at the time, we were preparing some pieces for a theater festival in Barcelona that we were going to. It was the International Schools Theater Association, ISTA, it's always called, that was doing a festival. And that year's meeting was going to be in Barcelona, and international schools from all over Europe were going to come there and present their pieces. And so I got home the night before the night that the wall was opened. I had gotten home like at 11, 12 from rehearsal.
Oh, like midnight.
Yeah, like late, yeah. Considering that I had school the next day. And I, you know, essentially fell asleep. But I had my alarm clock was actually just, I had my radio on a timer, so my radio would start playing like at 6:30. And so my radio woke me up, and of course that was the news that was on the radio.
Oh, you went to bed not knowing
I
stuff
had
was
no
happening.
Idea, no.
Wow.
No. My friends were dancing on the wall, and I just came home from rehearsal and went to bed. Like, I had no clue. Mm. And I was busy. And so
you had better things to do.
Things to do. I was like rehearsing pieces from, you know, Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods. I was busy.
I guess that sticks in your head now, right?
Totally.
You probably remember the exact song, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was Jack's mother. Anyway, but enough about me. So the next morning I woke up to this news and I'm like, oh my God, I don't even really remember. I have a really shitty memory. I'm trying to recall, you know, things that happen in my life. Sometimes I just come up with these huge black spots. And I haven't really even done that much to erase my memory. I don't really know what happened. But anyway, I woke up and kind of registered these news and thought, well, okay, wow. But at the same time, I had to go to school because I had rehearsal and, you know, it was going to be another week and we would go to Barcelona. So I went to school and, yeah, half the people were gone. There wasn't really...
Okay.
There was a lot of people at school, but the classes were generally half empty. A lot of the teachers hadn't shown up.
Yeah.
And we just kind of surfed through the day. But, I mean, it wasn't like this, oh my God, nobody's here. It's just like everybody knew what happened. So, you know, the administration and the students were like, oh yeah, well, obviously, why would they be here? I mean, a lot of these people had relatives in the East, of course.
Oh, sure. And they probably haven't seen them in
or ever seen them,
or,
you know,
yeah.
Or ever had the opportunity to see them just whenever they wanted. And A lot of people, you know, just were flabbergasted by the gravity of this political event. So, I mean, nobody was particularly surprised that half the people were missing, but those who were there just kind of enjoyed this day of talking about it.
And, oh, okay. You know. So you did, at least, it was like on your minds that you're discussing.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, obviously there wasn't any class to be held or any kind of like relevant material to cover or tests to be written. I mean, it was just us hanging out, you know, at school talking about the stuff and then rehearsing Into the Woods.
Okay.
So, yeah. And I didn't end up going to East Berlin for months.
Really? So a lot of people went east as well as west right away?
Well, yeah. I mean, people poured into the city, but yeah, a lot of people went east and said, oh my God, the border's open. I'm going to check this place out I've been hearing all these horror stories about. I got to check it out.
Yeah.
I had to look at it. And it does, I mean, it did at the time. It really was like walking into another world. Like before the wall opened, I had this boyfriend in ninth grade for like 3 months. We dated for 3 months, not very long. But, well, I should say that the school that I went to was a German-American school.
Okay.
It was funded by the Berlin government, but it was a bilingual school. Half of the people there were German, half of the people were American. There was double for everything. So obviously, you know, we were spun on the Western end of the political idea. So a lot of my schoolmates were actually military brats. And
That's why they were there. Their parents were in the military.
Yeah, because West Berlin was occupied, especially West Berlin was occupied by the American military. Yeah. And so obviously there was a ton of GIs living in Berlin and their kids needed to go to school. And so there was the Berlin American High School, which was the military school. Obviously they have their own. Mm-hmm. But there were other military people who chose to send their kids to not a military school. So that was ours, and employees of Pan Am Airlines and children from various embassy employees, you know, whoever ended up not going to the military school kind of ended up at our school.
Okay.
So I had a lot of military friends, and the American military families were, you know, they had special rights that German families didn't have, and one of those rights was free access to East Germany. Like, they could just show their military badge and just go to East Berlin.
Really?
Oh. Yeah.
Okay.
And so, through my boyfriend Kevin, at the time, I somehow got hooked up, because he was joining one of his friends whose parents were military, I think some kind of Air Force officer, to go for like a day trip to East Berlin, and I just tagged along. And it was like amazing. Like, I just remember walking through the streets of Mitte and everything was empty. It's like there was nobody on the street really. Everything was just a little bit dilapidated, not a lot of color. Everything's kind of like this, held in this general industrial gray and beige. It's really not a lot of color at all. And I don't know, like, I felt like, in retrospect, I almost feel like we were led or guided around areas where we couldn't meet anyone. No, it's kind of weird.
Oh, okay. You think it was almost like
I don't know.
Like on purpose.
Possibly. Who knows? I don't know. I was 15 or 16. I don't really remember about that day. But I do remember the picture. Just like thinking, okay, well, this is very drab. Very boring and very drab.
Huh.
And we weren't there for very long, just a couple hours.
Huh. And now did you sneak in somehow? Or were you?
No, we were with this Air Force officer who had free pass to go, and he just took us as guests.
Oh, he could bring guests.
Yeah, he could bring guests.
I see. Interesting.
Yeah, but then after the wall came down, I didn't go back until like way later, like until I was, 2 years later, maybe, I remember, or maybe it was less than that. Maybe it was when I was 18, but a couple of friends of mine had you know, who were way more adventurous than me and had way more spare time on their hands, had decided that they were going to open a bar. Because Mitte, what is now, you know, this super gentrified center of town where all the big businesses are and the government station, all that kind of stuff. I mean, that space was empty and had incredible amount of empty real estate in the smack dab in the middle of town. And so a couple of friends of mine had found this ground floor storefront that was unoccupied, and they had, I think, rented it for... It couldn't have been a lot of money, like 50 marks maybe, which is, I don't know, like 30 bucks, 40 bucks.
Yeah, so dirt cheap
dirt
real
cheap
estate.
Rent.
And they had
just put a couple of beer crates on the floor and just had carted in a fridge and sort of like opened this little illegal bar. And like when they had started to do this kind of stuff, I ended up tagging along every once in a while for a couple of beers in this illegal makeshift bar.
It's like a speakeasy almost.
Do
they have passwords to get in?
They should have had passwords. They should have had some awesome spy passwords, but they didn't. Yeah. But yeah, like slowly but surely, as my friends started to venture east, I also ended up venturing east, but never very much further than they did. So I wasn't much of an adventurer when it came to that stuff.
Well, I was thinking you're kind of like so cool that you had already gone to East Berlin before it even opens. Like,
again, tagging along, you know,
but that's like
hardly remembering a bit of it now. Bummer.
That's the hipster thing though, right? Like I was there before it was cool.
Oh, I think there was a few who had done. I mean, I think that the people who really had a connection were those people who had family, because you were allowed to visit family, like, in a limited way, and you had to be checked and rechecked, but you could get a permit from the East German government to visit the East, visit family in the East, and sometimes, you know, people from the East got permits to visit family in the West if, you know, they were considered, you know, a sure return.
Oh, so they were allowed. Okay.
It wasn't one of those things that was completely, you know, leak-free. I mean, there was plenty of communication across the wall and visits back and forth. I mean... I don't think that people would have acquiesced to the changes in the political system if it had meant never ever being able to speak to their brothers or sisters or parents again, because that's, you know, along the lines that people were separated that way.
Yeah. Were you separated that way at all?
No, which is probably why I had so little personal investment in going to see the East, because I had no family in the East. All of my family was in West Germany.
Oh, not even Berlin.
No, not Berlin, West Germany, like around Braunschweig, Brunswick, and, you know, like about 2 hours drive west.
So not much motivation.
No, there wasn't a whole lot of motivation for me other than, you know, curiosity. And my curiosity at 17 years old was for other things. I mean, it was super interesting to go to Barcelona with my little performance about 5 days after the wall opened, and then be talking to kids from all over the world who are like, oh my God, you're from Berlin. What happened? Tell us all about it. And, you know, I kind of let the other people in my troupe talk about it because I, you know, didn't have a whole lot of... It was kind of sad to be the one who hadn't gone dancing on the wall and, you know.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. I made up for it with adventure later in my life. But
that's good. It's all, your story almost has like a Rip Van Winkle quality to it or something. You just slept through it.
I did a little bit. I slept through a lot of it.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think it's like what we were talking about earlier, this, you know, there was no sense of urgency or emergency for me to do any of these things. There was no need.
Yep.
You know, I wasn't suffering.
Right.
And so I think that people are driven to explore or to find stuff out because they're missing something. I was never missing anything. I grew up in a very privileged environment. I was, you know, there wasn't, you know, any nagging questions that were, you know, that were bugging me. I was, you know, relatively well off and well positioned and free to do whatever I wanted and completely passionate about what I was doing that had nothing to do with history or politics or any of that stuff. And so for me to, you know, become involved in, you know, these forays to the East would have been, it would have required some, you know, motivation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't really have any internal motivation to do that. I took my friends to kind of drag me out of my bubble.
Hey, fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, over the years, though, you've done some exploring, right, worldwide. And done more traveling.
I have. I mean, I grew up traveling, you know. It's like,
oh, you did?
Yeah. I mean, the only reason why I ended up at this bilingual school was because my family had moved in 82, so when I was 8, my family moved to Southern Africa, to Lesotho, where my father did development work as a physician, and so the whole family lived in Lesotho for 2.5 years.
Did you guys just not feel comfortable being, or like you're only comfortable in enclaves? Is that it?
Yeah, possibly. No, we actually didn't get to decide where we were sent. I mean, my father went through training with this. It's an international development organization, like an NGO, like the Peace Corps. It's essentially Germany's version of the Peace Corps. Uh-huh. And you're assigned a particular region of the planet, but you don't get to choose where you go. So we didn't actually find out we were going to Lesotho until after the 3-month training period had gone through. And that year they sent a whole bunch of people to Lesotho. We were like 20 families that went there that year, which is weird because Lesotho's tiny.
But
so we lived there for 2.5 years. And at that time I didn't speak a word of English. And, you know, I was just, you know, kind of happy in my little third grade world in Berlin. And then the family decided to move, and the school that was an option for us was this place called Maseru Prep School, which is in the capital of Lesotho in Maseru. And they spoke English.
Okay. And do the people speak English in Lesotho?
So they speak Soto. Or Basotho.
Oh, they have their own language.
There's the local language, the local dialect. Then I guess one of the official languages there was English, because the Brits, the British colonial influence had, you know, persisted long enough to make English an official language.
Oh, okay.
But so this was a British school. This was like old colonialist, old school.
So this was a British colony? Like, how, it's just weird looking at a map, and you see this little country in the middle of South Africa, surrounded by South Africa. Like, what? How did that form? Do you know?
I don't even know.
But it's strange that happened.
Yeah, at some point I'm sure that I did know. I learned all this stuff once, but, I mean, Lesotho is just really high in the mountains. Uh-huh. I mean, it's essentially, it's in the Guinness Book of World Records for having the highest lowest point of any country in the world.
Highest lowest point. Oh,
right. So the entire country is so high up in the mountains that the lowest point of the country is higher than any other lowest point of any other country.
Wow, that's amazing.
Anyway, that's kind of a weird way to explain it, but anyway.
Yeah, I would think that's if you had asked me what do you think it was, I'd probably say Bhutan, but.
No.
That's really fascinating.
Bhutan is, I guess, big enough where it has, I don't know.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, so it's really high up in the mountains. It's a kingdom, I guess kind of a warrior kingdom. There's all these stories about how, you know, the Soto managed to sort of ward off people by climbing this mountain called, I'm totally like digging these memories deep out of the.
Oh, it's 35 years ago.
Yeah.
30 years ago.
It's this mountain called Tababusiu, and the legend goes that the warriors would go to the top of the mountain that was, you know, covered in brush, and they would essentially cut these paths into the brush of the mountains, and you couldn't walk up anywhere else. And then they would be at the top of the mountain, and when people would attack, they would just roll these gigantic boulders down these tracks that they had cut and just crush their enemies.
Cool. I mean,
I have no idea how much of that is real. But anyway, that was the legend.
Tell you though, I went to a place called Calab in northern Peru. It's like Q-U-E-L-A-B. And it's a giant fortress on top of a hill, kind of like that. Uh-huh. This ancient kingdom before the Incas, way before them. And the only way into this fortress is this narrow walkway, and it starts out maybe 10 feet wide. And as you enter the fortress, it narrows, so any army that wanted to attack would be forced to march single file at the end.
Yeah.
And there were guys just waiting for them 30 feet up with boulders just to smash on their heads.
Very effective.
Almost couldn't... There's almost no way to invade this place before the airplane or something. Yeah. But fascinating just to see, just to kind of visualize this happening and the bloodshed that would have happened there.
I know.
So maybe this is not so much just a legend.
Maybe this is exactly how Lesotho managed to maintain its independence. But I mean, when I lived there, it's not like Lesotho really was independent economically. It was completely dependent on South Africa, which meant that it was completely dependent politically as well. Mm. And South Africa, that was, you know, the height of apartheid. So it was really a weird and interesting place to be as a white person, member of an NGO that had been very vocal in its opposition to apartheid, which meant that we always had some serious issues trying to get into South Africa when we were trying to go anywhere.
Was Lesotho part of the apartheid, or did they have apartheid there? Or was
not
that
officially? No, no, they had a black, monarch. And a parliament, there wasn't really an occupying.
Okay, so yeah. So people there had more freedoms, or
it's so hard to. I mean, I suppose that people had more freedoms. I mean, I guess there was the glass ceiling was a little bit higher for people of color to move up because, you know, racism wasn't as institutional in terms of government policy, but. I mean, this was a developing country surrounded by South Africa, completely economically and politically dependent on South Africa.
Okay.
And so, you know, obviously apartheid policy would somehow spread.
Yeah, so no matter what they wanted, they couldn't avoid this,
no,
this apartheid,
I don't really
or whatever South Africa wanted. Yeah. You know.
I mean, yeah, I suppose that you could within, you know, small contexts, like villages, but not in terms of anything that had to do with employment or, you know, because most people would be, most men were working in South Africa in the diamond mines, not in Lesotho where you couldn't, you know, have a job.
Oh, so got it. Okay.
A lot of people were working in South Africa. But yeah, so here I was living in Lesotho with my family for 2.5 years. And so because that school was the only option for us, they just kind of put us there and said, okay, my mother taught me one sentence in English before I went, which was, I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Yeah.
And
that's all you spoke.
That's all I knew.
Wow.
And I went into school, and whenever someone would start to talk to me without using their hands and feet, or, you know, there was 42 different nationalities at that school, and there's a lot of people who were temporary, so the teachers were absolutely used to people not speaking English when they came. So they were really good at teaching it, and very patient and very skilled. And, you know, when I somehow managed to remember the whole sentence. I just remember being at that school the first time, and there was a super nice teacher who was supposed to help me with reading, and she was standing in front of me as a really tall person blabbering in a language I didn't know at all, and I was just like looking at her, shaking my head, going, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And like, what was that sentence that my mama taught me? Okay, I'm sorry, I don't... And I couldn't remember what that last word was forever.
Oh,
I was just like sitting there, and the teacher was just waiting with a smile on her face, like, I know you can think of it. What's the word? She knew what I was going to say, right? But
yeah, sure. That's a good way to do it.
She waited for me to say the word, and when I came up with it, when I said, I'm sorry, I don't understand. And she was like, oh, very good.
Yeah,
so great. And I'm like, it's great that I don't understand? Like, yes. It's great that you can say that you don't understand. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, with that kind of support, I learned English in 3 months.
Wow.
I was fluent in three months. It was just it was super easy. I have a talent for languages anyway. I tend to learn them through osmosis somehow.
Okay.
But,
they
made it super easy for me.
I mean, because now talking to you, I wouldn't even know that you're that you're German.
Right, and that had to do with, you know, when we came back from Lesotho in 85, you know, my mom thought, okay, well, I can't put her back in her old school. That's not going to work because she's just going to forget it all.
So
that's why I ended up in this German American school. She found a school where English was, you know, a teaching language, where I would, half of my courses would be in English. Mm-hmm. And back then I had a British accent.
Oh, interesting.
Because I had learned English from British people at the school. Yeah. And in the interview, like, people laughed about it because, you know, I had said, okay, well, I think there's some interview at the school to make sure that, you know, to check whether you actually speak enough English to be able to perform. And I kept talking about real English because people were talking to me in this strange American accent. And so I was like, okay, well, I can do this. I understand what you're saying, but it's not how you say it in real English.
Yeah. Little did you know that you would adopt literally accents.
Yeah. That is so perfectly. Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, I mean, I did all of my high school at this school. And then obviously after high school, left Germany for 12 years to go to the States.
Okay. So that's where you picked up this American accent.
I had the American accent by the time that I got to the States. I mean, being at school for so much of my time and doing so, all of my music and theater was taught by American teachers, and, you know, they were my big mentors. A lot of my friends were Americans. So whatever English I was speaking past fifth grade was American English, and I was speaking it every day. So there's not a whole lot of fluency that was, I mean, added once I actually lived in the United States. I mean, my English wasn't much different than it is now.
Oh, that's interesting. I would have assumed that that's where you learned most of it, or, like, at least shed your German accent that I would assume you would have.
Yeah, no, I never had a German accent. I think that's one of the things about my particular personal way of learning language, is that I'm very particular when it comes to pronunciation. Like, I don't care if I make grammar mistakes, but I want to sound like I'm actually speaking the language there, which is,
sure.
So if I, you know, if you guys had not been Americans, if you were British or Australian and I was exposed to you speaking for longer than, let's say, a day or two, I would immediately transform my accent and sound like you. I'm a little bit of a chameleon that way.
That's really fascinating.
And it's interesting with foreign languages, like French, for example. I was never really good at French. You know, my French is always more or less intermediate at best, but my pronunciation is really good. And so if I started saying things to people in French with the pronunciation that I had, they would just assume that I spoke fluently and started chatting me up. I'm like, oh, it's actually not like that. I just sound like I know what I'm saying.
Right.
I don't actually know what I'm saying.
Yeah, you almost have to throw in a fake accent just to so they understand that you don't speak the language.
But I don't.
Huh.
I think that's, like, the first thing that I want to do when I learn a language is shed the accent, try to sound as authentic as possible right away. And because I have a musical ear, that works pretty well. It's the first thing I know how to do.
Wow, that's cool.
Fake it till you make it.
Yeah. I'm thinking now, like, we kind of talked about Chinese a little bit, because I live in Beijing and I've been studying Chinese. I mean, the way you pronounce a word, obviously, in a tonal language is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of foreigners have a really hard time with the tones and getting the right one. And you might be just a total natural at this.
I would, except for the whole code thing.
Oh, the writing.
The writing
is a different thing. But, yeah, it's almost like learning two languages. You learn the spoken language, and then I'm separately learning the written language.
Exactly, yeah. I pick up the oral key.
Yeah.
Pretty quick, the auditory cues, etc. But
in terms of
writing, I'd be screwed.
Okay. But there's not a huge vocabulary either in Chinese as far as, like, different ways to pronounce words. I mean,
that's helpful.
Every word ends with a vowel or an N or a G.
I mean,
and they're all one syllable. I mean, it's pretty simple in that respect. So, other than the written part, I think you
Yeah, I'd probably take to it quick. I don't. China has not really been a dream destination of mine.
Sure, ever. Yeah.
I think there's so many other places that I would go to first.
Well, where else have you been in the world?
Not that many places, because I'm not big on the traveling everywhere I can get. You know,
like
I'm
very, day or two here and there.
Yeah, no, I don't really do that. So my traveling, other than like vacations or like whirlwind road trips, I mean, obviously I've seen, I'm going to say close to all of continental Western Europe, just because family vacations and road trips as a teenager and, you know, friends. Again, in Africa, we traveled around a little bit, so I've seen parts of South Africa and Botswana and Zimbabwe before Zimbabwe got gross.
Yeah.
And, but I haven't been back to Africa since, like, I went back once when I was 14, I think.
Also since the 80s.
Yeah, so I haven't been back to Africa since the 80s. Then when I was 19, I moved to the States to start college, and I was in Oregon at the University of Oregon. And so the couple of summers before I did that, Delta Airlines had this thing in the early 90s where, together with a transatlantic flight, you could buy a monthly pass, essentially, that allowed you to fly on any continental Delta Airlines flight for as often as you wanted within the 30 days that you were there.
Whoa.
And because I had gone to this German-American school, and a lot of my friends who had graduated before me or had gone back home, they were from all over. And so the summer before I finished high school, I took this deal, and I started to just visit friends trying to decide where I might want to go to college, because I knew I was going to go to college in the States, because my, to be honest, my high school performance was so rotten, my grades were so horrible, that I wasn't able to get the German high school degree, and I had to switch tracks after 11th grade to the high school diploma because it was so much easier than the German degree.
Oh, the American system's easier.
So much easier.
Whoa, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was so much easier. So much less science. Like, I had essentially completed all my science requirements for the high school diploma by the time I finished 9th grade, so... Anyway, I ended up just getting my high school diploma and just essentially giving up because my grades were so horrible. But because I come from a privileged background and my grandmother felt like supporting my wanderlust, she essentially said, you know, even though I'm not dead yet, I'm going to go ahead and give you all the money I was going to give you when I die and let you go to college in the States with it.
Well, that's nice of her.
It was very nice of her.
Yeah.
Because, it essentially gave me a college education that I would have otherwise not had. I wouldn't have been able to go to university here, or it would have taken me a lot longer to even get in.
Where did you end up going?
I ended up going to Oregon. I just ran around. I mean, during these two summers that I was flying around, I think I saw maybe at least 25 or 30 states in the U.S. just visiting people all over the place. And I ended up applying to colleges in Michigan, Colorado, and Oregon. Just places with trees, essentially. I like forests.
Yeah.
So I decided to go to places with trees. And I got accepted in all three states, and I ended up at the University of Oregon just because I had a friend in Oregon that at the time I, you know, had this secret little crush on, and I thought, you know, I'll be close to her anyway.
Well, that'll do it.
Yeah, I mean, we never really ended up, you know, seeing very much of each other, and that crush was over very, very shortly after, but it sent me to Oregon, and I love Oregon, and now that I think about it, it's just one of the best places that I could have ended up. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but Eugene, Oregon is, of all the places, of all the college towns in the U.S., kind of has this reputation of having the largest lesbian population. Maybe besides Madison.
Yeah.
And so I did not know that. I mean, I had come out the year before when I was 18. When I was 19, I came to the States, and I was just all excited about starting this whole new chapter, but I didn't realize that I was essentially going to the motherland.
Wow. So you just got lucky.
I just got really lucky.
Huh.
And I ended up just fitting right in. I had no problems adjusting whatsoever. I was just, floop, there I go.
Sure.
Just found my niche.
Yeah.
And, yeah, ended up not just spending the next 4 years there for college, but the next 12 years.
Wow.
Until I got kicked out.
Oh, the American government kicked you out? Like...
Well, yeah, I had chosen social work as an area of work, and there wasn't a lot of work for social workers, so it was very difficult to get a visa, and it costs a lot of money to do things like green card applications and things like that. So I had been working in the field of social work for a while, but it was very difficult to get a company to sponsor you for what was back then, it's called an H-1?
Oh, H-1 visa.
H-1 yeah. visa. And so I was on an H-1 visa for a really long time, but I had this tendency to get fired a lot.
Rejected just, over and over.
I just got fired a lot. I got fired like 3 times. And then I finally found this job that I really, really liked. I managed to kind of claw myself through and like reapply. And,
yeah.
You know, I'm like really good at solving problems. I get into this mode of, you know, here's a problem. I don't, you know, I'm not going to stop until I fix this. You know, if I was a better organizer, I could probably prevent all of these problems from happening in the first place, but that's not the kind of person I am. I'm just really good at dealing with them when I've caused them, I've caused them. So I had this employer and, you know, I was working there, and then the executive director switched from these very, you know, socially liberal Portland people to these Catholics from Wisconsin.
My home state.
Your home state. And they were horrible. They were just really bad, and they essentially forbid me to be out to the kids, and they were like horribly homophobic and sexist, and they started to revamp the whole organization. They were super conservative. And then 9/11 happened, and a lot of H-1 visas ended up not being renewed because, you know, Americans needed to do these jobs. And so I was caught in this political anti-immigrant surge.
Yeah.
And so at some point they just refused to renew my visa.
Mm.
And so I was fucked.
Yes.
There was no other way that I could get one. I couldn't marry my girlfriend. Now I could, but back then I couldn't.
Right.
And there was no social work jobs. I would have had to go all the way back to entry level jobs in order to be able to stay. And at some point I just said, okay, you know, obviously my time here has come to an end.
Yeah, it's too bad. I mean, you're definitely not the first one I've met who has had trouble getting a visa since September 11th.
And yeah, I have quite a few friends, especially kind of in the gay community. There's a lot of couples who ended up having to leave the States in order to be able to stay together. A bunch of people moved to Canada. I have some friends who moved to Belgium. There's only a couple of my friends from that time. We were part of this lesbian, gay, immigration rights task force, and we would meet regularly to somehow support each other. And so I have all these gay and lesbian friends in the U.S. who were trying to somehow stay together. And for many of us, it didn't really work out. Like, there's really only one of us who at this point is still in the States, has a green card. In fact, he was naturalized like 2 years ago.
Wow.
But he's also the one of us who had actual gainful employment because he's an attorney.
Oh, okay. But, yeah, that helps.
You know, the rest of us were just artsy fartsy people, and, you know.
Oh, being an attorney, it's not only gainful employment, but you also know the law.
Exactly. He's an immigration attorney, believe it or not. What a coincidence. So he was able to kind of figure his way through these issues. And he also was willing to allow himself to be just used and exploited by various employers, and unlike myself, who continue to get fired, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I didn't make it very easy for myself.
Well, so you came back to Berlin, right? And
first I went on a 3-month, you know, trip through Mexico. And
okay.
And then I came back to Berlin and had decided that, you know, obviously I'm not going to be a social worker in Berlin. So I started over and went back to school and got a teaching degree, which took me like almost 8 years to do.
Whoa. Oh, because you were working?
I was working, just because that's how long it takes here. You have to essentially do a double master's and then a 2-year internship, and it just takes a really long time.
Okay.
We're well educated as teachers.
Yeah. So,
like
for
a bachelor's degree and a year of student teaching, like it is in the States.
Yeah, yeah. That,
But yeah, like so
teachers at home complain about a 5-year program versus, you know, other college kids get only 4 years.
Yeah, I could have probably done it faster, but I'm just like, you know, I'm still not the most astute person when it comes to academics.
Yeah,
I'm not very good at going to school.
You're obviously really smart.
I'm better at teaching than I am at learning.
Okay.
Probably because I just realize how hard it is to get some of this stuff, and I'm good at simplifying. So.
Well, so then, yeah, I guess that's where you met Katie then, huh? You were in the middle of getting your degree?
Exactly. I was in the middle of getting my degree. I was just starting my first thesis, and as a means of making a living, I ended up doing this assistant teaching position at an international school in a preschool classroom. And I was the assistant and Katie was the teacher.
Yeah.
And that's how I met your girlfriend.
Yeah, so Katie's my girlfriend. She lived here for a couple of years, I think I mentioned at the beginning. And Lisa was her assistant. And you guys must have really hit it off. And
yeah. Enough to, like, voluntarily spend more time together after we just spent 6 hours together every day.
That's a lot, yeah. Yeah, a lot.
Yeah, that was fun. It's interesting, teaching at international schools is so much more fun than teaching at state schools because you have this little bubble of people who are all coming to teach there from different parts of the world, and so they naturally have this connection of being in the same boat, of being strangers in this country, and so they tend to connect and do more stuff together. Like working in a public school like I do now, there's not a lot of reason, there's not a lot of things that I have in common with my colleagues other than the fact that we all have to suffer or enjoy the same kids.
I'll relook at it.
Yeah. Sometimes it's both. But at these international schools, it's different because it's a little bit like this instant friends thing. I mean, all you got to add is this common stranger in a foreign land aspect, and you tend to gravitate towards each other.
Yeah, I'm definitely seeing this too, the appeal of this international school lifestyle. Katie and I live in Beijing, as I said, and we moved there not knowing anyone or not really understanding the culture and the language, and it was quite easy to make a lot of friends just from school because they were all moving there too, and like you kind of said about Germany, everyone's in the same boat, and it's this immediate instant friend base that I can definitely see wouldn't exist in a city where everyone's from that city and they've all got their own lives and everything already happening in the background.
Yeah, and having been a student in some of these schools, both in Lesotho and here in Berlin, I sort of already knew that if I was... I mean, the reason why I became a teacher is because I knew I didn't want to become a social worker because the pay is crap and I would have had to learn a whole new cultural background because I was working with Mexicans in the United States. Here I would have been working with Turkish and Arab kids. That's a whole different cultural background that I would have had to kind of immerse myself in order to be able to even remotely understand what people were going through. And I just wasn't really, I wasn't really up to the challenge. And I knew that I wanted to work with kids the minute that I had my first experience working with kids in social work in the U.S. So I knew that young adults were kind of where it was at for me, teenagers. And I knew that I wanted to have a job that would allow me to continue to live other places, to travel.
Yeah.
That would make me mobile, which is,
that's,
you know, history and English are great subjects to teach if you want to be globally mobile because you can teach those anywhere.
For sure.
Yeah. And so the minute I was done, I mean, even before I got my teaching degree, I had already applied to the State Department to be sent to one of the German schools in the world. And there's like 140 different German schools all over the world that you can be sent to. And the beautiful thing is that you make a German salary paid by the German government. It's usually pretty good.
Wherever
you are.
Okay.
And often it means making better money than you would here by a few hundred euros.
Yeah.
Plus, in a lot of cases, as what was the case for me, the money that you do make is worth so much more at the location that you're
sure.
at.
Sure, yeah.
So, yeah, originally when I interviewed, I had interviews with schools in Cape Town and Valparaiso, Chile. And then there was a school in Bethlehem that kept calling me. And I really didn't want to go to Bethlehem, and the other interviews didn't work out. And so this guy from Guatemala had called me and had said, you know, I'm going to offer you a job right now. I'm like, okay, well, I'm not sure I want to go to Guatemala. I'd really love to go to Chile, so let me see how this Chile thing works out. And if it doesn't work out, I'll call you back, which, you know,
it's
a risky move.
For sure, yeah.
That
window might not be open for long.
Yeah, it was a typical situation. None of the stuff that I was going for worked out, but there was the backup, and the backup was just nice enough to wait.
Okay.
And so I ended up finishing my degree, getting my degree, teaching here for a month, and then I headed out on another 2-month road trip through the States and a lot of Guatemala to kind of take over the history department, which I was going to lead, and then came back for Christmas and then headed out.
Well, so you drove, what, you drove through Mexico into Guatemala?
That was originally my plan, but I got distracted. I mean, I went back to Portland to visit my family of choice there, and then I rented this car, and the idea was to simply drive as far south as I could. But I ended up driving down Highway 1 for 3 weeks, and I kept stopping to ditch the car and hike into the woods somewhere.
Yeah.
And it ended up taking so long that I then just ended up booking a flight from LA to Guatemala City. So yeah. I had spent 3 consecutive springtimes in a row between 2004, 2005, 2006. Every spring I was in Mexico. I've seen a lot of Mexico during that time. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really feel like I was missing a whole lot.
Okay.
So I skipped Mexico. I didn't really feel like driving through the north of Mexico on my own anyway. It's a little sketchy.
Yeah.
And as much as I enjoy adventure, I think I have a different idea of what that might entail than getting stopped in sketchy towns in the middle of the desert in northern Mexico.
Yeah, sure. Understandable.
Yeah.
So you ended up teaching in Guatemala for a couple of years, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, cool. I was there for 2 years.
Wow.
That was cool.
I mean, we don't have a ton of time, but any highlights you want to talk about quick?
My experience in Guatemala was completely different than I expected. I expected Guatemala to be a little bit like Mexico.
Yeah.
I expected people to be open. I expected people to invite me into their homes. I expected people to be funny. I expected people to be somewhat rude and swear a lot, like all of my Mexican friends. and Guatemala, and I expected the food to be amazing. And none of those things that came true. The people were not open at all. People are very closed off and very, very guarded. And people are don't swear and aren't funny. They're very reserved and hyper polite. And the food is bland.
So nothing at all like Mexico.
Nothing at all like Mexico, except that the weather was amazing. And all the other stuff that I learned in Guatemala was just, you know, Guatemala is a completely different world that has a lot of things that I really grew to enjoy you know, I took a lot away from my time in Guatemala, but if there's anything that I can say that I really learned while I was there other than Spanish was about my own privilege and just how I just became so incredibly aware of all the different ways in which I am lucky and privileged and, you know, how very much one of the top 2% of the world population in terms of freedom and freedom of choice, ability to to be who I want to be, choose who I want to be. I have incredible, like, I'm so comfortable in my own skin compared to women in many Latin American countries, you know, like, I have so few issues around power dynamics and identity issues and gender questions and sexuality questions. All these things are, like real issues for, for women in that part of the world. And, you know, they've never been obstacles for me. You know, like when I came out when I was 18, that was totally cool. And I was raised a very powerful, almost dominant kind of person. And that was always accepted and fine. And then, I mean, I went to college in, you know, during the second wave of feminism in a place where that was part of the general curriculum. And I was, you know, part of a political movement, you know, at the beginning of the Clinton era that was, you know, very dynamic and very women positive. And then I go to Guatemala and it's just like this idea of standing up to men in itself was this huge step that people have yet to take. Or this idea of cutting your hair is like this huge question of personal, you know, it's like this step, this brave step that women take to cut their hair short. Or to leave their family and move, you know, to move into your own apartment without a man is like this, I don't know, it's just this.
Yeah, it's a big deal in anywhere in Latin America.
Something you shouldn't do, really, you know?
Yeah.
And just all these questions that a lot of young women that I got to know in Guatemala were grappling with and afraid of that I'm just like, oh my God, I feel like I've time traveled to to the 40s or the 50s.
Yeah.
It was that was very weird to move and live in a country that is generally, but especially among women, dominated by this underlying fear of everything, really.
Wow.
That's the feeling that I came away with. It's like this place is really, there is one emotion, one state of being, and that is being afraid or determining how much risk you are willing to take.
Does not bode well for the economy either and development.
Yeah.
Yeah, fear is not good.
Yeah, but then, you know, I mean, it's individual stories and it's always heartening when you observe people breaking out of predetermined patterns for them and watching, especially young teenagers, you know? I mean, I had students who were 16, and to watch these young 16-year-old women decide that they're not going to do this, they're going to do something else, and to be able to say, you know what, try it, you know?
Yeah.
If the results are not what you want, then, you know, you can always go back, but try it. And to be able to see people kind of start to break out of these predetermined patterns was really rewarding and...
God, I bet, yeah.
I mean, weird, because it was so... It's just a culture I'm not a part of, and so it's... You can't just go, well, this is, you know, your culture is bad. Your culture is not letting, is not setting you free, you know? You have the right to do this. You should do this. I'm like, no, actually, that's not what I can't do that.
Right, right.
But there was a lot of people who were really grappling with identity questions, as every 16-year-old is, and I think to be there and to watch that and to kind of get a grip on how this generation in Guatemala is probably going to change and how gay rights and women's rights and the separation from, you know, the Moors of the Catholic Church are sort of starting to become more and more acceptable. I think that's really been heartening.
So you did notice kind of a change, maybe not society-wide, but at least in the younger generation that they're changing their ideas?
Well, I taught at a very privileged school. I mean, these were rich kids.
So
they
have
a lot more
beginning.
Freedom than 80% of the population in Guatemala.
I see.
But I mean, the fact is, regardless of whether they're the majority or not, obviously they're not. They're the 1% in Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
But that 1% dominates all the cultural messages that people get, whether it's TV or radio or government policy. I mean, they're the ones who are going to be making the rules, so you might as well, you know, teach them.
Yeah, yeah, start at the top.
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel like I got a real, true connection to Guatemalan culture.
Because they're standoffish? Or?
Yeah, because there. I think if I had had 5 years there, I think it would have been different.
Oh, I see.
But it takes 2 years to be invited to someone's house.
Wow.
And after a year of not being invited to someone's house, I sort of gave up because I knew I wasn't just I was only going to be there for two. And so I ended up being in two people's houses. My friend Georgina, who's a colleague of mine, and my taxi driver, Axel, who I became really good friends with.
Okay.
But that's it.
It's amazing. I mean, I was just in Australia like 6 months ago, and I got invited into a number of homes within an hour of meeting someone. You know, it's so different.
Well, it also depends on how you enter a culture. You know, if I had entered the Guatemalan culture as a backpacker and had been 20 years younger,
yeah,
I would have ended up in a whole different crowd that is probably a lot more open. Like, I probably would have ended up in kind of the artsy-fartsy traveler crowd or the political activist crowd or whatever. But I entered the country as a 40-year-old teacher. And so in order for me to somehow enter more open and more alternative communities, I would have had to really work at it, to really move out of my comfort zone, to start moving freely around the city, to explore, to take social risks. And to be honest, like, this time around, I just wasn't in the mood.
You had a lot on your plate already, right? Just with
teaching. I think so. Just with teaching, with trying to learn Spanish, with trying to maintain a long-distance relationship across, you know, a time difference that meant I needed to be home in the afternoons to just be on Skype.
Oh, that too.
Wow. So I think that I probably could have gotten a lot more connection and a lot more out of these 2 years in Guatemala than I did. But that's just not where I was at. And it's not going to be the last time that I live somewhere for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and that's ultimately how I choose to travel. I mean,
I've gone
on vacations and stuff, and I've seen Costa Rica and El Salvador and Chile, you know, on trips, but that's not, I don't consider that to be honestly much other than my just relaxing in a pretty place.
It's not,
I haven't gotten to know those places.
It takes a long time.
Right. And yeah. And so, yeah, my education or my goal in life essentially is to continue to choose or possibly just be kind of washed up to new locations on the planet where I will then try to create a home, a temporary home. And I've done that, you know, or my parents did that in Africa, and I definitely did it in the States. And I feel like, you know, I could always go back to Guatemala and, you know, have, you know, at least a basic understanding of where I'm at. And but I think that, you know, within the next 10 years, that's going to happen again. And I will find myself at this point, I think at the minimum is 3 years, living somewhere new.
Okay.
And doing the same thing. I mean, to me, that's really the only way to gain any kind of long-term benefit from being on the road.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I've traveled a lot and gone to a lot of countries for even for a few months. Bolivia, I was in for 6 months. And yeah, I still didn't feel that connection that I feel with living somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I don't think I'm there with China yet either. But maybe if we end up staying a couple more years, I could definitely see it feeling that deeper connection.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a long time. But, you know, that's all right. It means you never get bored, right? You know?
That's true, yeah. Yeah, and I think, I mean, I understood more about Mexico in the 3 months that I spent there the first time I was there than I understood about Guatemala in 2 years.
Ah, okay, so it's a lot slower, too, on top of that.
Yeah, I think that Guatemalan culture is just so complicated and, mm-hmm. you know, in many ways so influenced by things like the Civil War and American imperialism and, you know, all these political aspects that come into play in shaping our worldview. And in Guatemala, you have to really work at figuring out, you know, where is this coming from? Why are people so incredibly closed off? And was it always this way, or did it happen because people were just, you know, governed by fear as a result of, you know, the Civil War in the 80s? Was it like this before then? You know, and then I was interviewing a lot of my Guatemalan friends about this stuff. Like, do you feel like it's always been this way? Do you feel like you've changed as a person or as a woman as a result of having lived through this war? Are there things that you remember, things that you don't remember? Like, how is this, how do you think this has shaped society? And, you know, in many ways, it's women in their 60s, women in their 50s and 60s that have taught me the most about why Guatemala is like it is. And if they've are the ones who have caused me to, you know, go, okay, make the step from going, okay, this is a really fucked up country. You know, this place is really, it's corrupt, it's violent, it's horrible. The people aren't friendly. I mean, they're polite, but they're not friendly. You know, like, it's these women in their 50s and 60s that have gone, yes, and this is, you know, the things that we have to deal with. And if you were in this situation, how would you treat others, or how would you approach others? And I'm like, oh yeah, I probably would spend more of my time protecting myself than reaching out. And I think that that's really kind of what Guatemala is all about, is, you know, those people who are reaching out and who are open are really quite revolutionary. And it's not regular.
Sure, sounds like it, yeah.
So.
It's really interesting how your impressions of a new country can change over time, and probably always evolving, however long you're there.
Mm-hmm.
So, any idea, just before we wrap up, any ideas where you might go? You're going to go somewhere new, or are you not even thinking that way yet?
A lot of, the older I get, the more the choices that I make are kind of governed by, you know, the conditions of my personal life. And, you know, it used to be like when I was in college, I was like free to do whatever I wanted and la la la. Now I'm in a relationship with someone who can't really leave this city or this country for long without having to completely revamp their entire life design. And so if I do go abroad within the next 5 years, I think it'll probably be within Europe. And, you know, my top choices obviously would be Spain, for the sake of being able to continue perfecting a language that I've grown to love.
With a totally
new accent, which I will immediately adopt, of course.
Yeah.
Turkey is super interesting to me, just because, you know, Berlin is the second largest Turkish city after Istanbul. And so it makes a lot of sense for me to explore Turkish culture.
Yeah.
And maybe learn that language. Not only because it's awesome, but also because, you know, that's half my students here.
Oh, okay.
So that would be cool. I really like the Adriatic Sea and everything around it.
Yeah.
It's going to be south. It's going to be something with more sun than this place. Right. I mean, come on. It's like, I have friends who chose to go to Norway, but I think they're insane.
Sure.
Not because the Norwegians aren't nice, but because the weather is crappier than here. And I mean,
I'm from Wisconsin, and just coming here in the summer, it's still just, I'm freezing.
Yeah.
Well.
But I mean, if I was unfettered by any kind of personal conditions, which I'm not, and I never will be because I'm old. That's not true. I'm older than I was. I would be really fascinated by, I would love to go to Indonesia.
Like
anything, I think Southeast Asia is fascinating to me. I'd love to spend some time in Vietnam or Thailand or Cambodia or Indonesia or the Philippines or anything kind of in that general area, not India, not China, but whenever you say not, that's usually where you end up, so who knows.
Katie made that mistake.
Yeah, exactly.
She said
Katie
not Western
makes
Europe.
That mistake.
She said not Western Europe, and she ended up in Berlin.
Yeah, you just get washed up, which is why, you know, yeah, I have some wishful thinking destinations, but ultimately...
Well, whatever you do, whatever you really want, you just say, no, I'm never going to go there. And it's the old trick. Sometimes people have played running for president. Like, no, I'm not running for president. No. Don't get me. Not me. And then, oh, no, we really want you. No. And then eventually they go, oh, okay, I'll be president. Fine.
Well, after they've been fundraising.
Yeah. Okay, I'll do it.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain parts of the world that I think I wouldn't want to go for to live. I mean, I would love to travel, but to live, I don't think that the Middle East is really my cup of tea.
It'd be hard.
That's not to say that I won't end up there. It's possible. I mean, our friend Kate never thought she'd end up in Saudi Arabia, and there she was.
Yeah.
That was weird. Mm-hmm. But, you know, things happen. You get washed up, and I've gotten washed up. Many unexpected places, and I think the minute that you just let that happen is when, you know, you can spend your worrying on other things that are maybe a little bit more relevant.
Yeah, and you never know. You might end up really loving a place, even though you have your impressions having never been there. Mm-hmm. You might come to change the way you think about what it's like there.
Yeah, I never thought I'd like Mexico when I first went. I just went there to learn Spanish because I was working with Mexicans.
Uh-huh.
I fell in love with Mexico so hard and so fast. It's like, I don't even know what hit me. Like, oh my God, Mexico. I love Mexico.
Yeah.
And I mean, that place too is huge. And there's definitely parts of Mexico that I'm not in love with. But
yeah.
And that's what, you know, got me into... Guatemala, eventually, over Bethlehem, is that I had fallen in love with Mexico so much, and I figured, well, Guatemala is an option, and it's got to be something like Mexico, and if it's anything like Mexico, it's going to be awesome. All right, here I go.
That's hilarious, because that's kind of why I went to Peru. Hmm. Boy, same exact thing. I went to Mexico a few times in high school and in college, and I just loved it. Just loved Mexico. And
yeah.
I thought, Peru is pretty much the same thing, same language. No, not really.
Yeah. No,
the language was more or less the same, although Mexicans kind of have their own language. But
yeah, I think I've learned from that mistake, like to assume that neighbors are similar.
Right. Yeah, not just, always.
Yeah. Germans and French are not similar either. Neither are the Germans and the Poles, or the Germans and the Austrians even. So.
Yeah.
I should have known better, but, you know, these are the things that make traveling and make living abroad so awesome.
Yeah.
Especially living abroad. I mean, I'm just really, I always used to identify myself as a traveler, but that's not true anymore for me. I'm much more of a liver than a traveler. I just like to live different places.
Cool. That's a great way to do it. And I've talked to so many people who have all their, you know, everyone's got their kind of own way of doing things, and that's kind of one of the reasons I started this whole podcast, even, is just to show people that there's not one right or wrong way to do it. You've got your way, I've got my way, and it's fine. Just get out there and explore the world however it works for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's cool when you realize you've got a whole lifetime to do it, too.
Yeah.
It's a cool realization.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of Americans get hooked on, because, you know, you have this problem of only having 2 weeks of vacation per year, and so people assume that, you know, if I'm traveling, I only have this limited amount of time, and so I just have to see as much as I possibly can, and you have, like, this typical American tourist who comes to Berlin for a day, and, you know, what should I see? And I'm like, how much time do you have? A day! And, like, you're insane! Stop!
Right.
But, yeah, I think that... You know, if you wanna see the world, that's not gonna help you. I mean, you have to find a way to spend more time in a place, and if it means, you know, volunteering or getting a job or taking a year off to work and make money somewhere else, or I mean, ultimately that's
I mean, even if you just have your 2 weeks and that's all you've got, you could not move every day, right? You could just go somewhere for 2 weeks.
Right. Yeah.
Get to know Berlin. That's what I'm doing here. We'll be in Berlin for a couple of weeks. I've never been here before, and I only know a very little bit of Germany.
Yeah, and I think two weeks is a more realistic time frame to get an idea of what you're looking at. You're still only going to see, you know, you're only going to scrape the surface. But I think two weeks is a decent amount of time to spend in a foreign city.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a few towns that, you know, I've been to where I would say, okay, you can do this town in a day.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Small
Antigua,
places.
Maybe. Antigua. But any kind of large city, like Guatemala City, you can't do in a day.
Yeah.
Not that I would recommend doing Guatemala City at all really.
Yeah.
But if you were, then it would take you 2 weeks.
If you are so inclined to get to know it. Yeah. Well, on that note, we should wrap it up. It's been a really great discussion. It's been so interesting talking to you, and I just really want to thank you for having this talk with me and coming on.
Anytime. We'll do more of them without the recorder.
Yeah, absolutely. So, see you later, folks, and we'll continue this without you guys spying on us. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For more information, you can visit my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number 1000daysbetween.com. From there, you can sign up to get updates from this podcast delivered directly to your inbox. Remember, the Around the World podcast is all about meeting ordinary people who have done extraordinary things. Thanks for listening.